Our first speaker is Dr. Konstantin Umansky, who's an associate professor of surgery from the University of Chicago Medicine and Biological Sciences. Dr. Umansky.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Dr. Clark and Dr. Halverson, for the privilege of the podium. I have no relevant disclosures for this presentation. Clostridium difficile infection over the past 20 years have evolved from a simple illness that oftentimes was considered sort of a nuisance illness by the providers into oftentimes a life-threatening condition. The statistics of C. difficile is staggering. In the report by Lesser et al., 153,000 cases of C. difficile infection were reported in 2011. 29,000 deaths and approximately a quarter of cases were community acquired. Nosocomial C. difficile is the most common pathogen in the United States, and it more than quadruples cost of hospitalization. And this in turn results in up to $1.5 billion additional dollars for the care of patients. The pathogenesis of C. difficile infection is fairly well understood. It is caused by anaerobic gram-positive bacterium, which is a spore former. It is transmitted by the fecal-oral route through the ingestion of the spores. The spores are extremely resistant to heat, acid, alcohol, and to many antibiotic treatments. It is causes disease by colonization without any invasion by mechanism of endotoxin, TCDA and TCDB. There are two endotoxins that elaborates. The toxins in turn exert their effect through signaling a raw family of GTPases. This in turn results in colonocyte deaths, loss of intestinal barrier and neutrophil infiltration, all of this amounting to damage of the epithelial barrier and severe oftentimes uncontrollable diarrhea. One of the main reasons why C. difficile becomes a pathogen is disruption of the barrier of the native intestinal microbiota. This colonization I sometimes think of as looking at the grass lawn. As if the grass lawn is healthy and opportunists such as weeds very rarely will start sprouting in that area. However, if the lawn is ill, and that's what happens when microbiome is disturbed, then the C. diff, whether or not it's have been previously colonized or newly contracted, can become a problem. And this is an issue, particularly when patients receive antibiotics, but also could be true with advanced age, antineoplastic therapy, and severe underlying disease. It's important to remember that symptomatic C. difficile infection does not develop in all of the patients which are colonized. And one of the critical factors to determine whether patients colonized with C. diff will develop illness is the virulence of bacteria. This became even more noted during early 2000 when the severe epidemic of toxin-producing C. difficile was noted in North America, particularly in the East Coast and in Canada. This was further characterized in extensive studies, which amounted to this seminal paper in New England Journal, which outlined the mechanism by which this newly found epidemic toxin gene variant strain of Clostridium difficile colitis results in severe illness. It was named NAP1027, and in some earlier studies it's called B1. This particular strain of C. difficile is notable for high level of fluoroquinolone resistance, efficient sporulation, very high toxin production, and what is most staggering is the mortality rate in person in whom disease developed is up to three times as high as that associated with the less virulent strains. This in turn likely contributed to the increasing rise in the C. difficile infection, and if you look at the slide, you notice that people who are older age, particularly in 60th to 80th decades of life, have the highest rate of increase of the C. difficile infection rates. And this trend continues to this day, with particularly older generation being affected by C. difficile. This diagram outlines the prevailing notion of how the pathogenesis of the C. difficile infection occurs. Most often it gets triggered with antibiotics. It could be also called confounded by additional factors such as advanced age and other factors. It can in turn contribute to the disrupted microbiome and disrupted colonic microbiota. In addition, if the virulent strain has been contracted or have been activated due to disruption of the microbiome, then it can produce to toxin production causing the illness. This does not automatically mean that the patient will progress to severe disease, as many of the patients have effective antitoxin response and therefore they become asymptomatic carriers. So that puts them into carrier group and not developing a formal disease. Some patients progress to diarrhea and colitis, and most of them will be treated. And those patients can progress to resolution. In addition to the treatment effect, their effective toxin, antitoxin effects, and then or they can progress to become non-responders with the recurrence. So as I mentioned to you earlier, antibiotic, and as most of us know, antibiotics is number one cause of the C. difficile infection. And over the course of the past 20 to 25 years, essentially every antibiotic have been implicated in the cause of C. difficile. Some antibiotics are more responsible for C. difficile than others. You notice the original one, which we associated with the C. difficile, clindamycin, followed by ampicillin, amoxicillin, cephalosporins, and fluoroquinolones. Some of them are less prone to causing C. difficile infection, but please note that an antibiotic that we all think of a treatment for C. diff has also been implicated, mitronidazole, uncommon, but can occasionally cause C. difficile infection in some selected cases. The environmental contamination is one of the major risk factors for transmission of C. diff and considered to be a risk factor. Particularly nosocomial C. difficile within the hospitals can be transmitted through contact with soiled furniture, stethoscopes, door handles, telephone, and pretty much anywhere where the healthcare providers or the patients can come in contact with. There's also a rise, as you remember in my earlier slide, up to 25% of patients are community acquired, which means by definition that the individual have not been in with an overnight stay in a healthcare facility within 12 weeks before the infection. While it does not rule out the transient hospital stay, it's still considered to be an infection that an individual can contract within the hospital. But there's this proportion of patients that present to the care of the providers without any contact with infected people or contact within a hospital environment or not having antibiotics. So a high degree of suspicion is key to understand that those individuals come to our care these days. This rate has increased dramatically and has become up to one-third of the new cases. What is important is those patients who come with a community-acquired C. diff are younger and more often do not have clear predisposing factors. Morbidity and mortality is lower, in part attributing to the younger and healthier condition of those patients. Up to 40%, though, require hospitalization, and the recurrence rate is surprisingly similar to those who acquire it through the nosocomial transmission. There was a lot of interest in literature to investigate whether acid suppression has a role on C. difficile infection and transmission. Even though the C. difficile spores are remarkably resilient to acid, the thought was that maybe the acid suppression somehow decreases the chance of the spores being inhibited or suppressed. And even though there were studies that were some data supporting the notion that acid suppression may increase risk of infection associated with C. difficile, others found that there's no clear connection. And currently, while this issue remains somewhat controversial, there's no clear evidence to support the notion that acid suppression results in increased rates of C. difficile infection. Other risk factors, as I previously mentioned, include advanced age, inflammatory bowel disease, organ transplantation, chemotherapy, chronic kidney disease, immunodeficiency, and exposure of an infant to the adult who is a carrier of C. diff. There's an important entity which we as surgeons encounter quite often is severe C. difficile illness. It's defined by a patient who is exhibiting signs and symptoms of systemic toxicity and can be further worked up with the laboratory evaluation revealing the white blood cell count exceeding 15,000, hypotension, hypoalbuminemia, respiratory compromise, and acute kidney injury. The risk factors predisposing the patient to developing severe illness is advanced age, severe initial episode of C. difficile infection, and those patients who unfortunately require ongoing use of antibiotics despite the known diagnosis of C. difficile when they have another life-threatening infection that prevents providers from stopping antibiotics. Unfortunately, severe C. difficile infection is the independent predictor of mortality and death, and those patients, which we will hear about those situations later in the talks, will require urgent colectomy. But even though they still have a fairly significant infection-related mortality and all-cause mortality, 15 to 20%. The diagnosis of the C. difficile infection has undergone major improvements, and currently we are benefiting from rapid and very reliable assays. One of the major breakthroughs in diagnosis of the C. difficile was the use of the assay to detect toxins, TCDA and B within the stool by ELISA, enzyme immunoassay, and used to be a mainstay of testing. While this test is accurate, it's noted to be somewhat slow and requires at least 24 hours or more for the results to come back. Currently, the test that's used by many hospitals is becoming more prevalent is the test based on the PCR detecting a DNA, the toxin-coding DNA of the bacterium itself, and it is detected in the diarrhea stool. It is fairly rapid. Results can be returned in many instances the same day, but definitely within 24 hours. It is very sensitive, more sensitive than ELISA, and therefore it's been adopted to many hospital laboratories across the country and the world. The PCR also can be useful in detecting the toxigenic strain of the NAP1027 bacterium, and if it's detected, appropriate medical treatment and isolation protocol, as well as epidemiological maneuvers can be initiated if that strain is detected. However, with the more sensitive and accurate test, there are some drawbacks. There is some evolving concern that PCR assay for C. difficile infection may be too sensitive. What they do is they can show higher incidence of infection that it really exists, and also they can detect low level of toxigenic organisms that are of uncertain clinical significance. So the current recommendation in some publications is that some of the positive DNA tests in the absence of the diarrhea can be further confirmed with sequential testing using PCR followed by ELISA. And in some situations, positive PCR can indicate that the patient is a carrier because they do carry genes for toxin-producing bacteria, but they do not have toxin in their stool, and therefore it's no longer required treatment in that situation. Both tests, ELISA and PCR combined together, have extremely high negative predictive value of 95%. Endoscopy, which was one of the mainstay therapies before the molecular tests became available, is not frequently used and only rarely employed in such cases where additional information could be clouding the diagnosis, such as presence of inflammatory bowel disease. Finally, I'm going to talk about the prevention of C. difficile as the last point of my talk. And the two aspects of the prevention have been widely adopted and agreed upon, such as the infection control and antibiotic stewardship, and then the prevention of the spread in the healthcare facilities. The two other factors that have been extensively investigated but still are not agreed upon is the role of probiotics and vaccines. So the role of antibiotic stewardship has gained interest in several centers across the world, and particularly one hospital in Scotland conducted a study where strict antibiotic stewardship controlling for use of ceftriaxone and ciprofloxacin were able, in combination with educational program, reduce the rate of C. difficile infection by 77%. However, these heroic measures can produce outstanding results. They're sometimes difficult to sustain, and many authors think that it might be too labor-intensive and not sustainable in the long term. The area where we can have the most significant impact, however, is the infection control or prevention of the spread in the healthcare facilities. This is something that most of us and most of the hospitals that we practice on have adopted with various success, but one thing is clear, that patients with known or suspected C. difficile infection should be isolated in a single room. The gown and glove precautions have to be used, hands washed with soap and water, and importantly, a thorough post-discharge cleaning must be utilized. It cannot be overemphasized the importance of a hand hygiene. And while everybody understands that soap and water is the only real way to remove the spores off the hands, the abundance of the alcohol-based hand sanitizers in some way prevents us from routinely and continuously using hand washing. So it is important for us to remember that if the patient has any suspicion for C. difficile, then we must protect ourselves and our patients by thorough hand washing with soap and water. What about the probiotics? There's a lot of interest in literature in the probiotics, and unfortunately, there are mixed results, and there's not really a consensus in literature in that regard. Probiotics are thought by some authors to confer significant protection in cohorts with unusually high rates of the C. difficile infection. By other authors, disagree, saying that they do not see any protection in hospital patients who had low rates of infection. On the summary, it is thought that currently probiotics have no certain role in C. difficile infection, is either routine use or certainly not as a treatment for active infection. Finally, I will talk about immunization and vaccination. This is an area of active interest. Some of the fascinating basic science comes from the observation that infants exposed to C. difficile can actually develop a durable immune response, which actually protects them from developing C. difficile diarrhea later in life. There was some literature on passive immunization, providing the patients with monoclonal antibodies to C. difficile toxins with moderate success. It provides substantial protection from recurrence after acute infection, and also is considered to be cost-effective in patients who are at high risk for recurrence. But what is the most effort is directed currently is in development of vaccine. So there was two phase one studies that initially piloted with healthy volunteers against the TCDA and TCDB toxins. And the clinicaltrials.gov listed two trials, one by Sanofi, and unfortunately that study closed because the study board determined that the study was unlikely to achieve any clinically meaningful outcomes. But the study by Pfizer continues on, and currently it's in phase three with results expected in 2020. The goal of vaccination is to prevent active C. difficile infection, but its clinical utility will depend on numerous variables, particularly its safety, which is very important, efficacy, cost effectiveness, and also with evolution of our ability to detect C. diff earlier and more accurately, the role of vaccine and effective treatment against C. diff may be reevaluated. It also is key to remember that transmission of C. diff may not be affected by vaccination, as it is likely that those individuals who are vaccinated while they're not developing a fulminant infection may still be carriers. It is likely that the vaccines are going to play some role, and once they develop, their role in some high-risk population will increase as we move into the future. So with that, I would like to stop and turn it over to the next speakers. Thank you.